Welcome to Constitution Ave, a new podcast where we dive deep into the week's hottest news topics from the halls of Congress to the Oval Office. I'm Sam Dorman, and these are my co-hosts, Nathan Wester.
Hello.
And Jacob Berg.
Hello.
Today we're going to discuss the Federal Aviation Administration's efforts following high-profile plane crashes, Big Tech's court battles over alleged antitrust violations, and Harvard suing Trump over his DEI policies. Jacob, what are you hearing about the airline industry and some of the trends that are developing there?
Thank you, Sam. I'm Jacob Berg, and I cover aviation and national politics. Let's go back a few months to the evening of January 29th, when an Army Black Hawk helicopter collided with a commercial jet, killing all 67 people on both aircraft, just over the Potomac near Washington. Then, just 2 days later, a medical transport plane careened into a Philadelphia neighborhood, killing seven and leaving more than a dozen injured. Within weeks, we would see a Delta flight crash land onto a runway in Toronto before catching fire, skidding across the tarmac, and flipping over, miraculously only causing injuries to some on board. Later, a plane clipped the tail of another in Seattle, a flight in Houston was evacuated after catching fire, and a Southwest pilot narrowly avoided a collision by boarding a landing mere seconds before a private jet taxied across its targeted runway. Americans are naturally wondering, does this mean flying is becoming more dangerous? Is aviation no longer the safest form of travel? Luckily, I can dispel those fears for you today, not just with the data to back it up, but with two veteran pilots and aviation experts with decades of experience under their belts. The National Transportation Safety Board, or NTSB, which investigates aviation incidents, has copious data to back this up. So far this year, we have not seen an increase in aviation incidents compared to the previous years, going back at least a decade too. In fact, there has been a slight decrease. But you may be thinking, if the data is showing a dip, why does it seem like there's a new accident or incident every single week? Wouldn't this mean air travel is getting more dangerous? In reality, this isn't new. Last year, a door panel ripped off a Boeing 737 MAX right after takeoff in January, leading to increased oversight from the FAA and a flurry of media attention on everything aviation related, a similar situation to what is playing out now. Shem Malmquist, who has worked in the industry for nearly 50 years, piloting commercial jets, teaching as a professor, and consulting on safety, told me that our brains have a tendency to recognize patterns.
When you have a situation happen or you have events that make a lot of news, it makes it so other events that happen are more prominent in your mind. It's literally a type of heuristic bias that we have as humans, where we see something. The truth is, the same thing even happens, like you are trying to buy a new kind of car, and then you get it, you're driving around, and all of a sudden you see a whole bunch of them on the road that you never noticed before. It literally is how our brains work. So part of this is not that events are happening more often, but it just seems like it because you notice them, because once you get it into the news and you see it in front of you over and over, your brain pattern matches and catches that. And so that's part of what's going on.
Additionally, he told me that the collision near DC in January was the result of many close calls over a long period of time. Richard Levy, who worked for more than 40 years as a pilot for American Airlines and now consults on aviation safety, told me that the helicopter routes in DC were too close to the commercial planes coming and going from Reagan National Airport.
No business doing night goggle training by the airport. Now, at 9 p.m., no business doing that. Do it at 3 in the morning. Do it at 4 or 5 in the morning, no later than that, when there's no traffic, when there's no takeoff.
Luckily, as Levy told me, the Transportation Department and FAA moved swiftly to change these routes to avoid further accidents. The NTSB also said that crash was caused by more than just narrow flight routes. Critical transmissions from air traffic control to the helicopter were overridden or stepped on by the pilots pressing the microphone button at the precise moment the transmissions came through. So, if aviation remains the safest form of travel, how do we make it even safer? Well, Trump's Transportation Secretary, Sean Duffy, has already suggested overhauling and upgrading air traffic control's computer systems while also hiring more controllers. Earlier this week, he said it was time to upgrade the FAA's Notice to Airmen, or NOTAM, alert system, which essentially tells pilots what to expect from airspaces or runways upon approach, such as closures, bad weather, or in the case of a plane shot down over Ukraine in 2014, to avoid the airspace altogether. As Malmquist told me, notice to airmen alerts are needlessly cryptic, technical, and difficult to decipher. The critical one in 2014 was a string of code numbers and a few words, rather than telling the pilots that 14 aircraft had been shot down in that area in the previous 3 months alone and to avoid it.
The notam that they had for that airspace, which you can see, like, and no one can make heads or tails out of. And it gives you an idea of how, like, this is something that's a really serious thing, and the way it's written just does not come across that way.
Levy agreed. He told me that when he flew long international flights, he and his co-pilots were flooded with the cryptic alerts. He welcomes the FAA working to upgrade the system and make it more understandable.
To read the NOTAMs, go flying from the U.S. to Hong Kong, which they said was 16, 17 hours, there's lots of NOTAMs, and it's almost overwhelming. Now, the dispatcher for the airline you're flying for will comb through the ones that are most important. If there's something very pertinent, that the runway will be closed upon arrival. The airport will be, traffic will be decreased because the president of XYZ is arriving. You need to know that. But they were archaic in that they were low. They were just so many together, hard to read. Now they're going to use new technology, AI, and the cloud, so that they're updated, they're rapidly, they're fluid. In other words, if something changes, something closes, or something is reopened, we'll know right then and there. And it's also the readability will be improved. So that I'm excited about the NOTAM, that it's going to be a safer situation.
Malmquist said AI can be helpful as long as we're not relying on it to make decisions in place of humans. He also cautioned that upgrading air traffic control systems and computers could unfortunately come with a few hiccups.
But if we do upgrade it, we have to be really, really careful. There's big changes. Because every change you introduce, let's put it this way, most accidents occur after some sort of change. So you make a major change and you are opening yourself up to new scenarios that you just didn't anticipate at all. So there's a huge risk involved with upgrading. So upgrading needs to happen, but you have to do it really carefully. And what that's going to do is put more burden on the pilots to try to prevent accidents where the system isn't working the way we expect. And the reason we have pilots on airplanes is specifically to manage scenarios that could not be anticipated and designed. If you could anticipate every single scenario, you wouldn't need pilots. But we are nowhere close to doing that.
Now, as far as hiring more air traffic controllers, Levy said that having additional employees could help the current staff to work fewer days in a row on the same salary, while also adding more eyes to the control room.
With extra controllers, we have an extra set of eyes. They're listening on the radio with binoculars. If it's in the control tower, obviously. If it's downstairs in the radar room, then it's another set of controllers just watching as a supervisor does to have a backup in case something slips by or for space in between airplanes. So there's one advantage of more controllers.
Overall, it's all about minimizing risk in air travel, both pilots tell me. Even if flying is the safest way to get from point A to point B, these are some of the options available to make it even safer. So the next time you're getting ready to board a flight and you worry about a recent headline about a near miss or an engine fire evacuation, just remember, accidents are going down, and it's just your brain making you think otherwise. Now, let's hear from Sam on an interesting court case involving major tech companies that many of us use every single day.
Thanks, Jacob. Let's switch gears to another highly scrutinized industry. I'm Sam, and I cover courts like the one in Washington, D.C., that's been holding a trial in the Federal Trade Commission's lawsuit against Meta Platforms, which is the company behind Facebook and Instagram. The FTC is arguing that Meta violated antitrust law by buying up competitors rather than competing in more traditional ways, like improving its product. More specifically, it said that the company's purchase of Instagram and WhatsApp, a messaging service, helped give it monopoly power over the market for personal social media networks. At the start of the trial on April 14th, CEO Mark Zuckerberg testified and fielded questions from an FTC lawyer who walked him through communications between Meta executives. The questioning seemed designed to get at Meta's intention for acquiring Instagram and its view of competitors around the time of the acquisition. Meta ultimately bought Instagram for $1 billion and later bought WhatsApp for $19 billion. Whatever the outcome of the trial, this lawsuit and others could have big impacts for the industry. For example, the FTC has asked that Meta be required to divest from both Instagram and WhatsApp, in addition to other potential changes if it wins. Meta, meanwhile, has maintained that its practices benefited consumers. Attorney Mark Hansen, who represented Meta, said during opening arguments that the FTC was wrong to claim that his client violated the law. Meta's services, he underscored, didn't cost anything for consumers. In fact, he said, the intent and effect of its acquisitions were to benefit U.S. consumers. The FTC's lawsuit is one of many antitrust lawsuits big tech companies are facing from the federal government, which recently scored a win against Google in Virginia. There, a federal judge said that Google violated an antitrust law through a monopoly in its advertising technology business. On the other side of the river, Google is facing potentially large-scale changes as it enters the remedies phase of another antitrust case in Washington. In that case, another federal judge ruled that the company had violated antitrust law with its business for search. Some of these more antitrust actions have become controversial among analysts because of the legal questions involved and concerns about whether they align with consumer welfare. Dr. Ted Bilema, a former Justice Department attorney who worked on antitrust in the 90s, told me that antitrust enforcement had changed since his time in the executive branch.
The concern I have right now is what DOJ is asking for relief doesn't fit the violation. They're talking about breaking up Google, about taking away Chrome from Google. But that's not what they're asking for. They're asking for potentially divesting Chrome.
Yeah.
And that just goes way beyond what they proved in court. And then another issue on that, too, is it's not clear that's good for consumers either, that the revenue from Chrome comes from, connecting people who use a search engine to merchandising through Google. So that's where Google makes their money off of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not clear anyone else could operate Chrome as a free service the way Google has.
Yeah.
So, I'm worried this could be bad for app developers and for people who shop online and rely on Google for it.
However, some of the more recent antitrust prosecutions have garnered support from both parties. The Meta lawsuit, for example, was initially brought in Trump's first administration and revived under former President Joe Biden's FTC. In Google's other antitrust case in Washington, Trump's Justice Department is picking up where the Biden administration left off in pursuing the tech giant. Part of what it's asking for is that Google divest from its popular browser, Chrome. Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, who represented Trump in his New York trial, said on April 21st that Google has deplatformed conservative speech and has put its thumb on the scale politically for years. All of this behavior is downstream from Google's monopoly over internet search, he said. These antitrust lawsuits are just a subset of the growing number of lawsuits the administration is fighting, including many brought by outside groups challenging its policies. Now let's go to Nathan, who has some information on Harvard University's attempt to challenge Trump on DEI.
Thanks, Sam. I'm a national politics reporter based in Washington. In 2021, future Vice President J.D. Vance borrowed a line from Nixon. Here's what he said.
The professors are the enemy.
That line stood out to me when I heard it in person at the National Conservatism Conference. 3.5 years later, it seems like an early hint of a major war. Trump and the universities are now locked in combat over DEI, campus protests, and more. The biggest, baddest fight pits the president against a symbol of the American elite, Harvard University. Trump froze billions in federal funding to Harvard, demanding that it make changes to admissions, hiring, and key programs. The university then sued, alleging that the government was undermining its academic freedom. Harvard's Alan Garber was one of 150 university presidents who co-signed a letter objecting to, quote, unprecedented government overreach and political interference, unquote. But some in higher ed sympathize with what Trump is doing. I spoke to a few.
I think it's actually very healthy for universities to be forced to answer to sort of the man in the street, whether that comes in the form of donors or state legislatures or the federal government or whoever.
That's Patrick Gray, a professor and dean at the University of Austin, or UATX. It's a new institution focused on merit. Kids with high test scores get in automatically. The Texas school also stands apart on academic freedom.
I think academic freedom should be more limited in scope.
But why? Isn't academic freedom a good thing?
It depends on what academic freedom means. The University of Austin has its own view, one with which some would disagree, but others might see as more honest.
Because what we realized is no institution can, in fact, be entirely neutral. You have to have some mission about which you are not neutral. That is your mission, and everything is aligned towards that goal. We do try to allow maximum freedom for the students. You know, students are young. They should be allowed to kick around ideas all the time.
UATX is not so neutral when it comes to hiring and designing courses. And though they're politically independent, Gray certainly sounded positive about Trump. The school has raised over $200 million so far. Supporters include big-time Republican donors like Harlan Crow and Jeff Yass. Still, they would take federal funding. But that might change if a future administration mandates things they don't like, such as DEI. For now, Gray seems optimistic.
If the federal government wants to jump on that train and help us, great. I hope it just keeps on going in that direction.
Things look different from Michigan at Hillsdale College. The conservative Christian school doesn't take taxpayer funding. Would that ever change with Trump in the White House?
Absolutely not. No. That would be a dreadful mistake.
That's David Whalen, a professor and associate vice president of curriculum at Hillsdale. Hillsdale and UATX differ on a few things. While UATX puts merit first, Whalen said Hillsdale also scrutinizes students' character before admitting them. But when it came to Trump's moves, they weren't so far apart. Whalen told me liberty must be balanced with civility, and he doesn't think Trump's actions jeopardize academic freedom.
I see it as an attempt to restore and buttress academic freedom.
Hold on. For our listeners that may be curious, are these experts saying academic freedom is a good thing or a bad thing?
I'll say it again. It depends on what academic freedom means. Leo Kerner sounded pretty skeptical that it matters much at all at Harvard, the school at the center of the controversy.
We've come to the point where there are basically no conservative professors at all.
The numbers back him up. A 2023 survey found that under 3% of Harvard professors see themselves as conservative or very conservative. Kerner leads the school's Republican club. He thinks the school's been ideologically captured, and he backs Trump against the Harvard administration.
I think it's totally within the right of the federal government to restrict funding that their taxpayers paid.
Trump's demands to Harvard include more viewpoint diversity. Of course, the politics in Harvard Yard aren't unique to that school. I wanted to share some pretty interesting numbers with you. This is from a study in 2021. It found that almost two-thirds of political scientists in the U.S. who they surveyed called themselves not just Democrats, but strong Democrats. So, Sam and Jacob, I'm wondering, how many, what percent do you think called themselves strong Republicans?
Oh, I don't know. Probably less than 20% or fewer.
2%.
How many?
Two.
2%? The number, according to this study, 0.58%. That's about 1 in 200 political scientists called themselves strong Republicans, as compared to, again, two-thirds calling themselves strong Democrats. So, you know, J.D. Vance talking about universities being the enemy, it's pretty strong language, but as a Republican vice president, he's probably not wrong. Well, Sam, I mean, getting to the nitty-gritty here, as a court specialist, what do you think of the Harvard lawsuit and some of these other lawsuits, other actions taking place that might bear on what we're seeing with universities?
Yeah, I'm not really surprised given the lawsuits we've seen so far. It was interesting, though, that Columbia had a standoff with the Trump administration over anti-Semitism and eventually gave into its demands when millions in federal funding was at stake. So I think what Harvard is doing is pretty audacious, and it'll be interesting to see what happens with it. As for how or whether the Supreme Court will rule on this, I'm not sure. The lawsuit itself is something, it seems to be hitting on an issue that's been recurring in some of the other lawsuits facing the administration. And that's whether these types of lawsuits that challenge cancellations or freezes should be brought in regular federal court or the Court of Federal Claims. So earlier this month, the majority of the Supreme Court removed a lower court's block on Trump's freezing of education grants. and those were related to DEI as well. In a brief opinion, it said that the administration was likely to succeed in claiming that the lawsuit should have been brought in a different court. And it pointed to a law known as the Tucker Act, which grants jurisdiction over expressed or implied contracts to the Court of Federal Claims.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I'm wondering, too, just what all of this means, you know, given the overall historical context of university funding. This was a point that Dr. Whalen brought home to me, but the real expansion in terms of federal involvement on the funding side took place during the Cold War. That was a context of increased spending on science and engineering and related areas. A lot of that ended up going towards universities. And that is the same period of time that post-World War II, early Cold War era, that you started to see federally guaranteed student loans, which it's interesting. I think people might not have a sense of just how recent in historical time this is. And it is interesting to consider just exactly what sort of effect it has, positive, negative, neutral, for there to be this level of involvement of the government in shaping universities. But, you know, Jacob, you mentioned that there might actually be a playbook here that the Trump administration is borrowing from in what we've seen.
Yeah, absolutely. So as the resident Florida man of the group, I feel like I will have a unique vantage point to speak on this. Our governor here, Ron DeSantis, who ran against Trump in the presidential GOP primary last year, he, during his second term as governor, moved to clamp down on a lot of the state universities and did much of the same, although some of the requests from his administration to the various universities were a little bit more vast than what we're seeing so far from Trump. And in some cases, it was a matter of removing DEI programs from individual schools or teaching critical race theory or related programs. In other cases, it was completely overhauling an entire school and changing who was running it. And I had spoken to some of the students in the years following the actions who, you know, were a little bit worried about just having a particular, government administration stepping in and making decisions for these universities. And I think the fear then was if it proceeds at the rate it was moving at, is it going to continue? Is it going to snowball into something bigger than what we've already seen? Where are the requests going to eventually lead? And so I think that's some of the fears I see kind of being spoken right now in reference to what Trump is doing. You know, there's a lot of, particularly, especially Democrats, that are worried, you know, maybe now it's starting with anti-Semitism and other, you know, related requests from the administration, but, you know, how far is it going to go? Is it going to be limited to some of these carve-outs that they've already started to discuss, like anti-Semitism and DEI? Or if the administration is successful in getting these schools to adjust their programs the way they're asking, are they going to go further? And so that's something I'm going to be watching for and curious to see play out as, you know, this entire situation unfolds.
It's interesting just looking at this, because I think that Trump is going further than other presidents have in terms of trying to freeze spending. And there's definitely more of a cultural interest in some of the way that the law is being enforced. So I think with universities in particular, it'll be interesting to see how Harmy Dillon, who's leading the Civil Rights Division in DOJ, will influence some of these issues. And then, of course, you had the Supreme Court decision 2 years ago on Harvard's admission policies and affirmative action. So there's an opportunity there for the Justice Department to act in a particular way. And those all those things dovetail with, you know, DEI, critical race theory, and Trump's also taking actions on gender. So
it's very interesting to see this and consider the president that J.D. Vance quoted way back in 2021, Richard Nixon. And he was elected not only in the aftermath of the creation, many of the policies that are now being rolled back by the Trump administration on civil rights grounds, ones that they contend are discriminatory, but also in the aftermath of very similar campus protests. You had buildings being occupied. You had a great deal of ferment in the country over the Vietnam War at that point, not the Israel-Palestine conflict. But in some respects, history is not exactly repeating itself, but it certainly seems to rhyme. And I'm not going to forget that speech from J.D. Vance anytime soon. Certainly seems like something that has set an agenda that we have not seen fully played out.
All right. Thank you for listening to Constitution Ave with Jacob Berg, Nathan Wester, and Sam Dorman. Join us again next week for the most intriguing topics in news and politics. And be sure to subscribe and give us a favorable rating on Spotify and Apple Podcasts.